I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle is a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
Well, today we're talking with Dr. Randy Woodley, who is the author of a book that we just read called Indigenous Theology and the Western Worldview. He's also the author of a ton of other books. He literally published 3 books this year. I wrote a chapter of a book this year, so, you know, got me beat. And he is an Indigenous theologian. He's also a seed farmer, is that right?
Yeah, he's a distinguished professor of faith and culture and director of intercultural and Indigenous studies at Portland Seminary. And he co-hosts Piecing It All Together podcast with Bo Sanders, and he's written a bunch of books. And then he and his wife, like you were alluding to, Kyle, he and his wife Edith are co-sustainers of Elohe Indigenous Center for Earth Justice and Elohe Farm and Seeds. Yeah. And so he's a seed farmer and tries to grow and sustain organic indigenous heirloom seeds because he really cares about the land and the earth.
Yeah, and we talk about that quite a bit in the interview. We talk about a whole host of other things, too. This was probably, of all the interviews we've done, the least we have stuck to a script, which kind of fits the vibe of the book. It's very narrative-based. It's all about the differences between what he calls the Western worldview and the way that Western theology tends to be practiced, and a more indigenous way of theologizing and thinking about life. And it's very much narrative-based and very conversational, so it makes sense that we would veer from our script a little bit.
I absolutely loved this book, and it made me so inspired to, like, the indigenous theology that he kind of presents reminds me so much of the prophets in the Hebrew scriptures and of the Jesus way in the New Testament. And it's so... The saddening thing as you read it, the grievous thing as you read it, is that it's so different than this colonized version of Christianity that the American church has. It's just so obvious as you read this and as you reflect how other our Christianity has become because of who we are, where we are, and when we are, really.
Yeah. As he says, you can be a Christian and follow Jesus, but it's very difficult.
I love it. I love it so much.
If that piques your interest, keep listening.
Yeah. So what we do here on the podcast, if you're new, is we sample a tasty alcoholic beverage because we are a pastor and a philosopher walking to a bar, and why wouldn't we sample something as we're talking?
Why not?
And so today, our friends at Story Hill BKC in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, have a special gift for us. It's a New Riff single barrel, and it's a barrel select, so you can literally only find what we're tasting at Story Hill BKC. So if you're in Milwaukee, go there now and ask for it. We're going to find out how it is. But if you're not in Milwaukee, go to some local establishment and see if they have any barrel select special bourbons, because it's just fun that we get this one barrel that once it's done, it's done. Nobody will ever have it again.
It's going to be a little bit unique from all of the other ones. We've actually had one pick of New Riff before on the podcast. I don't know if you remember, our friends from the Power Bourbon YouTube channel sent it to us, and we loved it.
So Shout out to those guys.
I'm pretty excited about this.
Yeah. This is a high cut. It's 112 proof. And it smells high cut. It smells hot. It reminds me of like a glue stick. The nose.
Yeah.
A spicy glue stick.
Yeah, it's best smelling glue stick I've ever
A delicious glue stick.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's complex.
It's fruitier than I was expecting from the nose.
It's hot as hell. Holy cow.
It's a little more grainy than I remember the other one being, but it's got that heat, the depth, the...
It's really good.
Yeah, the rich, dark fruit character.
Yeah, blueberries.
I think it's lighter in color than some other barrel picks I've had. Not like...
I mean, it's 4 years old, light, so it's not super, super old, but there's just so much going in. And it's one of those bourbons where each part of your palate gets something different for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, rich, toasted butter, buttery goodness is in there, too.
Yeah, buttered toast. That's... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I get, like... cinnamon, clove, nutmeg a little bit, some of those fall winter spices.
Some of my favorite tasting notes in bourbon, especially those dark spices.
Leather and wood on the end.
Love it.
That's good. That's a serious bourbon, though.
Yeah, barrel proof. I just love barrel proof. I think all whiskey should be barrel. I can't say that. If a master distiller wants to cut his whiskey or her whiskey, then more power to him. I just won't buy it.
Yeah, I'm giving into the fat a little bit, the trend, because most of the barrel proof that we try are delicious, but this is hot. Like, you might want a little couple drops of water to open it up. As a matter of fact, let me try that.
Yeah, I'm going to do that as well.
Oh, wow. So different.
Yeah.
Holy cow. That's really good, too. It's velvety.
Yeah, it's like a cream soda now.
Yeah, it's creamy, smooth.
Still hot cream soda.
That's good, though. Man, cut that with a couple drops. I recommend that. That's good.
Yeah,
see, usually, which tells you they should have cut it.
I don't think so. I put literally four tiny drops of water in this.
Yeah, but it does. And it
is
it.
No, it is really interesting. Usually, I wish I hadn't, but in this case,
yeah,
it's
and I would
really enjoyable.
I would recommend just a little bit of my bourbon snobbery, which I have tiny bits of because I'm a novice. But two things: you hear the Kentucky Chew. Let me do it one more time for you. Just oxidizing it, sucking it through your teeth, letting it dance over your tongue. It really brings it to life. I can't drink bourbon without doing that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is when I really want to taste something, I close my eyes. Because then I'm really tasting. I'm only tasting. I'm not looking at anything. And I'm smelling and tasting. That's all I'm doing. And that's when those deeper things on the palate come in.
I need to refresh, like, scientifically on what's happening when you add a few drops of water. It's not just that it's diluting it.
No.
It's not. It's actually awakening something. Like, it's making it so that there's, I don't know if it's more evaporation is happening right in that moment, or there's some chemical reaction that's making it so the flavor
is, well, it is just diluting it, open, I think, right? Scientifically, I think. But it is, but whiskeys are such that there's this supposed to be a sweet spot where you cut it just enough for its characters to really sing, and only master distillers can know what they think that should be. But that's why you have all these gradients, is because some whiskeys are better full strength.
Yeah.
Other whiskeys are not. All of a sudden you hit this, you just add a little bit of water and you're like, oh, well, there it is. I've actually, with a friend who's a amateur distiller, participated in doing the cuts. And he had all these different, you know, this is full proof, this is 90%, this is 80%, blah, 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 went down the, and there was clear differences
in
quality.
Yeah, and if you don't know what you're doing, you can easily overshoot that, which is why it's so dangerous to start pouring water into your whiskey, and why it's stupid to put ice in your whiskey.
Yeah, agreed. So, again, if you're in Milwaukee, get yourself over to Store Hill BKC, grab the New Riff Single Barrel Select, and thank us later. Tell them the podcast sent you, and if you're not in Milwaukee, support local, and cheers.
Cheers.
Well, Dr. Randy Woodley, thank you for joining us on A Pastor and a Philosopher Walking to a Bar.
Yeah, I have a question about that.
All right, fire away.
What do they say when they go in the bar?
You know, we should come up with a good answer to that.
We should. We
need a punchline.
No good answer, Dr. Woodley.
We don't have one.
Yeah, it's like, usually it's like, and the pastor said yada yada, and the philosopher said yada yada.
Yeah, you have to tune in to find out the punchline, I guess. Yeah. Okay. We just like to drink, man. I don't know.
We do.
Well, you heard the one about the man, the dog that walked in the bar, right?
Nope.
Why the long face? Oh, was that the horse? That was the horse.
No, that was the horse that had the long face. So the guy walks in, you know, and he's got a dog with him. The bar owner says, "You can't bring a dog in here." He goes, no, this is a talking dog. He's like, right. He goes, no, he is. If I can get him to talk, can you front me a drink? He's like, oh, yeah, go ahead. So he asks him, he says to the dog, what's on top of the house? He says, roof. And then he says, who's the greatest baseball player of all time? Roof. And the bartender says, I'm not giving you a drink for that. Get out of here. He throws him out, and they're walking down the street. The dog turns to him and says, was it Ty Cobb?
That's good.
Nice.
There we go. So, Randy, this is where we normally ask our guests to tell us about themselves, but you opened up your book saying that in your, and I'm going to not get this pronunciation right, but in your Kitawa tradition, you're not supposed to talk about yourself. Can you just tell us about that?
Well, you know, it's sort of like that verse in scripture that says, like, you know, give honor to who honor is due, and let other people sing your praise. So the idea is, if you're going to talk about yourself, you're probably not very humble.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you want to talk about yourself, or should we do that in the beginning of the
episode?
Yeah,
I'm not very humble, so that,
you know, works out.
All right. So tell our listeners about yourself a little bit, Randy.
So they can find out more at elohe.org. So my wife and I have a place called Elohe Indigenous Center for Earth Justice and Elohe Farm and Seeds. So we're farmers and we're teachers, and we have a community, and we have our cultural ceremonies and things here. And yeah, it just becomes a sort of a all around center for gathering and, you know, people learning stuff. So yeah, and we've been doing that on and off since about 2004.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So the book is Indigenous Theology in the Western Worldview, A Decolonized Approach to Christian Doctrine. I absolutely loved this book. And you've written many other books, correct? Or a number of other books.
Yeah, I published three this year.
Yeah, we got a mailer from the publisher, and there was a list of your books on it, and I looked at the dates, and they were all 2022, and I was like, what the heck?
Yeah, we call that a monster of a writer.
What's
this
guy doing?
Last year was a good year for writing.
Good, good. Well, so right in the beginning of your book, you say that you and your wife's work with your seed company, preserving open-pollinated, organic, native heirloom seeds, is every bit as important to you as your theological work, and that you don't see a difference between them. Can you explain that to us a little bit?
If I don't see a difference, I don't know how I'm going to explain it.
What would you say to someone who sees a big difference?
Yes.
I would ask them how. I think that form of what I would call superficial categorization is kind of endemic to the Western worldview, right? And so everything is categorized separately. But in my worldview, you know, like, these seeds have everything to do with everything. Without seeds, we don't eat. Why farm if we're not going to eat? You have to understand the land. You have to understand the gift it is from Creator. It's all interrelated. So, you know, it's like there's a way that you look at life and you just say, like, everything's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So you don't have, you know, you talk a lot about dualism, binaries in your book. And seems like in the indigenous worldview, it's less categorical and less broken apart, less kind of decentered, and more just kind of, like you just said, everything. This is all one life that we're living, and everything relates to one another. Is that right?
Yeah. So this extrinsic categorization that occurs in the West, there's really nothing wrong with that. I think it actually is a gift. So, you know, I'm really glad that I have not just a general practitioner, but I also have a cardiologist, and I also have a podiatrist, and I also have a neurologist, and, you know, and they all specialize in their certain areas. But like, if one treats me out of just their concern for my body and doesn't take consideration of my whole body and what's going on with everything else, then I might end up dead.
Mm-hmm.
So the point being is that when we categorize in these, I can just call them superficial categories, these extrinsic categories, it's okay. It's okay to study deeply in certain areas. But the problem with the West is it begins to act as if that category is all of reality.
Yeah.
And so then that becomes a false reality. So I call it putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. The West has to begin to understand that it's just like all the work that's been done on the last, you know, 60 years on psychosomatic illness, right? At first, people were probably going, you know, there's nothing to that. In fact, I remember when they were saying there's nothing to that. And but to understand that our bodies and our minds, and then I would add our spirit, although I don't believe in a tripartite person, I think we're all one whole thing.
Hey, me too.
It's helpful sometimes to talk about them in this way, right?
Yeah.
But let's remember that we are all of those things. We're not just one of those things. And that's exactly the definition of dualism, is to say, the Platonic dualism is to prioritize the ethereal or the abstract or the mind or whatever over the material world, over the body, over the earth, etc. And so, you know, we got to keep it together. I guess that's a good phrase we can use.
Yeah. Amen to that. So you talked about superficial categorization. I assume that implies that you think there are some categories that aren't superficial that are worth preserving. So what's your method for distinguishing?
Well, basically their relationship. Like, so we have, like, let's just talk about the animal kingdom, right? So somebody thought of, you know, and I forget them all, but they are like, you know, kingdom, phylum, species, you know, yada, yada, yada. But so in the native world, it's like the things that fly, the things that crawl, the two-legged things, the four-legged things, the things that swim, you know, the things that have roots, the things that have wings. So those are categories that create everything that's related to that is that, right? So they're more relational, I would say.
That's interesting. So I'm going to get you to define Western worldview in just a second, but I think this will play right into that, because what you just described is very consonant with Aristotle. And so he would be, if I had to pick the progenitor of the Western worldview, I don't think I'd do much better than to pick him. So I'm curious what similarities or major differences you see in what you just described as the indigenous worldview versus what you're calling Western.
Yeah, and this is great. Great to have a philosopher to talk about these things with. So I go back to what we really don't know what Socrates said, because everything is written by Plato, right? And other of his works were destroyed. So it's hard to know where Plato begins and Socrates ends. But I go back to Plato's, placing more privilege on the ethereal, the abstract, the Plato's cave kind of a thing. And and then as his student, Aristotle didn't buy into, as you probably well know, didn't buy completely into that. But with Plato's idea of different kinds of people and all of those kinds of things, and that the mind being central and everything else sort of being subsidiary. And then, as we get to people like Descartes, who said, I am a soul, but I have a body, there's been this kind of like long thread of this dualistic thing. And so Aristotle, yes, categorization, that's one thing. Was it Aristotle or was it Plato who did the metals, people as metals?
Yeah, it was Plato.
Yeah. So, but Aristotle, as people have said, is perhaps the father of modern racism, because he said, well, some people were slavable and others were meant to rule slaves, right? And of course, whoever makes those pronouncements generally sees themselves as the ones who are supposed to rule, right? Yeah. Coincidentally. So that is the beginning, as far as I can tell. I'm sure they got it from, somebody else, but that's the beginning, as far as I can tell, of this idea that we are separate from our minds, or that at least that part of us is privileged, as opposed to what I would call a holistic reality. And so from an indigenous worldview, we would say we are all of that. So for example, an indigenous doctor in the old days, there's a few that still do this, but mostly in the old days, would go and ask you when something was wrong, like, what have you been eating? What are your relationships like? What have you been dreaming about? Have you gone somewhere you weren't supposed to go? Just sort of like all these things that would seem somewhat random to perhaps a medical doctor now, but they would understand them as all being related somehow, because they're part of a bigger worldview, more holistic kind of a worldview.
That's fascinating.
Fun. Yeah.
I'm going to switch gears entirely here and ask you to tell a story that you tell in the first chapter of your book, because it's set in Wisconsin and we're in Wisconsin. So you talk about only speaking in places where you've been invited, and a story that you tell about a particular speaking occasion you had in Wisconsin where you realized you hadn't been invited by the relevant party. And so you set out in search of this person and came across a boy who had an LSD trip. It was just this whole involved really interesting story. And I wonder if you could tell maybe an abbreviated version of that for our listeners.
Yeah. So this is up on the Lac-Couturier Reservation up in around Hayward. And so just before I had arrived at this place where this YWAM base, where we were supposed to do some teaching for the week, training Native leaders. And there was a young man there who they had just picked up, and his story was like he and his brother had an acid trip in Seattle. I think they were in Seattle, and they were adopted out from that Lac-Couturier Reservation. And he saw Jesus there in his trip, and he told him to go back to his reservation. Well, so he got picked up, I think the night before, or maybe even hours before we got there. And so my first question to the proprietor was like, who invited you guys here? And he said, well, it was the pastor of the church next door, and they gave us the land. And I'm like, well, what tribe is he? And well, he's Mohawk. He's not, So who gave you permission from the people here? Nobody. So before Now, if you'd have said, yeah, we were welcomed by the Le Coudray people, and, you know, that would have been fine, but they weren't. And so I needed to figure out who it was. And so I took this young man with me because he obviously had been raised without his culture, and I wanted him to see, like, this is how you do things, right? Hmm. So we, I'll shorten this up. We go into the store, and I buy this big basket for and fill it with all kinds of stuff that you would give elders as a gift basket. We found out where he lives. He was the advisor to the tribe from the elder group, and also one of the leaders of the particular religion there, the traditional religion. So I thought we were about the right person. And so we went, big snowy day. The guy started talking to us, asked what we wanted. I explained, you know, why we were there. And then he started telling us stories, right? But every so often he would say, my uncle, who trained most of the medicine men around these parts and in parts of Canada and Minnesota and other places, he lived to be 107 years old. He trained most of the medicine people around. And he always told me, he said, don't disrespect Jesus because he's a great spirit. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. So he would go on and he'd tell another story. And he had a lot of stories within the story. We were there for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But every so often he would break in and say that same thing. My uncle would say, you know, to me, don't disrespect Jesus. He's a great spirit. And so he finally got toward the end, I think, of his talk with us. He said, so I asked my uncle one time, uncle, how do you know all this stuff about Jesus? And he said, well, I told you, I talked to him. And he said, yeah, but yeah, you know all these stories, though. Did you go to boarding school? No. Did the priest come and talk to you? No. Did you go to church? No. Do you have a Bible? No. He said, I told you, I talked to him. And then this elder says to us, and so I asked my uncle again, yeah, but how do you know all this stuff about Jesus? And my uncle, he says, looked at me like I was a child and said, well, of course he talks back. And then he said, now I'm going to pray for you and ask for a blessing, and you're welcome to stay here and speak. So so that was the story, right?
Yeah.
And I told that deliberately to that group because it's a bit of a hoity-toity, the Hayward Lectures. And I wanted to create some disequilibrium, right? Because I knew that that in that particular crowd and genre that they would be extremely critical. So I thought, I'm going to create disequilibrium because I did that particularly because in that liminal space is where you actually start to listen to people, right?
Mm, yeah.
And listen to other things that you don't normally hear. I want them to know you're going to hear stuff that you don't normally hear.
While we're talking about Jesus, let me ask you about a thing you say in the book. At one point you say you can be a Christian and follow Jesus, but it's very difficult.
And so I always tell people I'm not a Christian. We practice our native traditions, but we follow Jesus. But I like to add the caveat, you know, you can be a Christian and follow Jesus, but it's really, really hard. You know, it's hard to do.
What makes it hard?
And that's mostly because, you know, Western Christianity is basically the tool of empire. I mean, it's there's like all you have to do is know history, right? And we can say as much as we want, yeah, but those weren't real Christians or that, you know. But the bottom line is what has represented Christianity to the world in the West, particularly to Native Americans, but other folks too, has been an oppressive regime of empire. And so Jesus is antithetical to that sort of Christianity. Jesus is actually the decolonized mind, the one who comes against empire and illegitimate powers, the one who resists in so many ways, like Walter Wink would say, Jesus' third way, right? Mm-hmm. So how can you follow Jesus in the midst of an oppressive regime? Well, it is possible, but it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it okay if we camp out on this topic for just a minute before?
Yeah. Let me just ask, do you think that word Christian or Christianity is important at all?
To who?
To, like, if I identify as a Jesus follower, is that word Christian, do you think it's too loaded in the American context to even be valid or worth hanging on to?
Well, I think so. I think, first of all, you know, we have to realize that Jesus never became a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And, And I think he came to start a movement for anybody, mm-hmm. not for a particular religion. And but I'm sure, absolutely certain that if he came to start a religion, it would look nothing like Western Christianity. So I'm pretty sure we're on safe ground. And then if you want to be biblical, you can find out that no one in Scripture ever called themselves a Christian. And there's actually, you know, a few books out now who talk about it wasn't until the 3rd century that anybody ever did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do you understand Jesus's relationship to American indigenous religious traditions?
Yeah. So all the people, so I pastored a native church for 7 years and I've been in and out of the native community for all these years. And I've found very few people who have a hard time with Jesus. They like him. They think that he's great. They think he's like our medicine men, that he's a prophet, that he's, you know, and so there's a pretty high regard, but not the Jesus brought by the colonizer mm-hmm. or the missionizer. That Jesus has just come to take things away. And like for Native America, you know, I've my good friend Richard Twist, who's passed on, used to say it this way. The missionary said to our Native people, Jesus loves you, but he doesn't really like you. He doesn't like your yeah. language. You have to get rid of that. He doesn't like your long hair. He doesn't like these dream catchers. He doesn't like whatever else that's mm-hmm. native. He doesn't like that. So basically, Jesus doesn't like you, but he loves you.
Yeah.
And that's a very weird kind of a message, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in your, so speaking of mission and missiology and indigenous cultures and Jesus and Christianity, you tell a story in the end of the book about a person who basically evangelized, I hate that word, but I'll just use it, evangelized this indigenous people group. And he said, I just told the story. He said something similar to this. You'll know it better than me. I just told the story and I let them theologize it. Explain exactly. that.
Yeah, that was a wonderful time. I had lunch with one of my good friends, one of my students, and became a friend. Her grandfather, who was a missionary to the Calahan in the Philippines, and they all became followers of Jesus. And I asked him, I said, you know, how did this happen? And he said, it was pretty easy, really. He said, I just told the stories and they did the theologizing. And I think that was actually how the scriptures began. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of everything we have there was actually oral at one time, except for Paul's letter writing campaigns, mm-hmm. which were all addressing some kind of occasional, you know, problem in the church. But so yeah, it's orality is what's most natural to tell the story. But then and this is part again of the extrinsic categorization. We want to chop them up into, you know, chapters and verses. And then we have rules about how we, hermeneutical rules about how to interpret that and the verses around it. And instead of just going, hey, it's a story, let's hear the story, and then let's take it from there. And how we understand story, of course, is very different, too, between the West and indigenous peoples around the world. You know, the Bible being mostly story, about 90% story. And in the West, it's sort of like the first reaction is it fact? Did it happen? Mm-hmm. And that's truth to the West. Whereas other peoples around the world and indigenous peoples in this continent, the first thing is like, what's the truth in the story? Mm-hmm. That's what matters.
Yes.
Not did it happen, mm-hmm. but what's true about it? What do I need to learn from it? Yeah. You know? So I think it just, the whole thing is kind of the West is created the Bible as the, you know, fourth person of the Trinity. We call it biblicism. But, you know, we've got to stop that. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So one last one before you take it back over, Kyle. For those of us listening or hosting who don't have a PhD, can you tell us what you think he meant by, I told them the stories and I let them do the theologizing? What does that mean?
Yeah. So I think, and I have friends who disagree with me, Native scholar friends, who would say, you know, I'm glad the scriptures are translated in our languages, etc. And I'm not one of those. I think we had our own ways of remembering and learning story and listening to story, and they should have just been given orally like they were meant to be. Hearing something is different than reading it. Hearing a story, and in fact, I during my work on my PhD, which, you know, was like 3 years there, I didn't read the Bible once. I only listened to it. If I had something I needed to reference, I would ask my wife, can you read this to me?
Wow.
I wanted to experience it in a more indigenous way than that, you know, going to and reading and finding the verse and chapter. And so it made all the difference in the world of how I began to hear things. Mm-hmm. These are stories, and it's really important to listen to the stories. And then each person, culture, group, whatever, then needs to figure out, like, well, what does that mean based on my worldview? Mm-hmm. And of course, then, you know, I'm 100% behind all the studying, letter writing in antiquities and, you know, the original languages and everything else, because they help us understand the social background and what's going on. That's all important stuff. We can't, if we need to apply it to us, we can't apply it to us unless we understand first what it meant to them, right? Mm-hmm. So, but then those stories also are given to us in our cultures, and we begin to theologize on them and say, like, well, in my culture, that might not mean the same thing as it does in their culture. And so I have to figure out what that means. But if I have someone else telling me what they think it should mean, then it's no longer my story. Mm-hmm. It's their story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Let me ask you just a couple more questions about Jesus, and then we can move on to something else. Although, let's be honest, it's all about Jesus in some way. You say at one point Jesus was an indigenous man. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, he was like a, you know, brown-skinned dude from a village and a tribe, and he certainly relates, I think, much closer to what we would consider indigenous people now than post-Enlightenment Western people. Mm-hmm. And he understood story, I think, in the way that more indigenous people do. He had the opportunity to talk about all kinds of things, you know, inventions and modern stuff that the Romans had invented. And yeah, but he ends up speaking almost exclusively, not about those things, but about the things in nature, you know,
seeds and dirt
and fields and dirt and, you know, trees and birds and, you know, plants and, you know, and so, he just seems very much like an indigenous person to me.
Yeah. So then how do you understand, cause he's also Jewish, right? So how do you understand the relationship between a Native American Jesus follower and, I don't know what you'd call that, Native American Christianity, for lack of a better term, and Judaism, right? Because colonial Christianity has had difficult histories with both. Mainstream Christian theology has been both anti-Native and anti-Semitic. So you're an indigenous theologian who follows a first century Jewish man. Is that a complicated integration?
Not at all. I think it's very helpful to, you know, to sit with my Jewish brothers and sisters and hear what they had to say. In fact, last Friday night at Shabbat, my wife and I spoke at the largest synagogue here in Portland. And we talked, they asked us to talk about what it means to be indigenous and what Jews might learn about their own indigeneity.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I think there's so much there in common that, yeah, there's a whole field of openness and response that could take place. That's, so it's, I think we inform each other. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. You say in the book that your theology starts with the land. It starts with the earth. White American Christians can be listening right now and get a little bit freaked out about that and think that that might be a little bit heretical. What do you mean when you say your theology begins with the land and the earth?
Well, what do you mean by saying it doesn't? Because, I mean, that's abstract, right?
Okay.
So it's got to begin somewhere, and it's got to begin physically. Everything rests upon the earth. You know, I stand upon the earth. God puts us on the earth. Where else could it begin? I mean, this is like the first teacher and the first home, and you know, everything about it is a gift. So how could it not begin on the earth? I don't understand how you would start somewhere else.
So if someone would say my theology begins with Jesus or my theology begins with God himself, you think that's silliness?
Yeah, well, I would say, well, that's very abstract, because God gave us a manifest, you know, Jesus on earth and gave us everything that we have on earth. So if you say I begin with God, then you're beginning with some abstract idea. Mm-hmm. So, it's think about it. Like, how else do you actually begin a theology? This is the earth was here long before there was a Bible. You know, it's been teaching us, creation has been teaching us ever since human beings are walking the earth and learning from the rest of the community of creation and everything else, because that's the way Creator intended it to be. And even in the first chapters of Genesis, you know, you have this great, you know, earth and everything else is tov meod, right? It's very, very good. And then in Genesis 2:15, you have the story of like, what are human beings being created for? To care for the earth, to co-sustain, not to rule and dominate. That's a misunderstanding of the whole context, but to tend the garden, to be what I call co-sustainers. And so our very purpose as people is to care for the whole community of creation, mm-hmm. or the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's our first task. It's beautiful. You've mentioned Creator a few times, and I love that. You also mentioned in the book, you mentioned Creator and Great Mystery. Can you just define those terms for our listeners?
So, I mean, we have to turn to Kyle here, and like, if something's a mystery, how do you explain it, right?
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
He's uncomfortable with mystery.
I am. I'm very uncomfortable. Yeah. I'm uncomfortable with mystery as a terminus to a dialectic, but I don't think that's how you're using it.
I'm saying Great Spirit is probably the most theologically accurate name for God that we have.
Great Spirit. Okay.
It means that this is the greatest mystery there is, right? And the wonderful thing about diversity and different people's understanding, their understandings of who God is that we all come together and there's this big picture, right? But still, even with everybody, it's still like, this is beyond our comprehension. It's a great mystery. So we say Creator, like where everything comes from, right? And we say, one of the words that we have in my tribe is Unethlanahi, which is like the one who's behind everything, right? And the sun's the most visible, you know, symbol of that, if you will. And so they used to call us sun worshipers, because we would, like, you know, put our hands up and pray to the sun. And there's a whole thing about Southeastern sun cult and all that kind of stuff. But no, it was the one who was behind the sun. Hmm. And it was just the physical manifestation of that one that seemed like the greatest representation. So, yeah. So, you know, I think those words are as good as any.
Yeah.
Be better than some.
Is Creator gendered in indigenous religion?
No.
Okay.
There's so many things I want to ask you.
I know.
We don't have time.
We were just laughing that this is our most unscripted interview we've done maybe ever.
Like, I didn't put anything about gender on the outline, and now I want to talk about it.
I know. Yeah.
Well, good. Because I'd rather do an impromptu thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So where we actually deal with what our real questions are. So, and those change, right? Process is the most important thing to me, because it's the process that creates that sacred moment that can never be repeated again.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. So you mentioned going to the elder in northern Wisconsin, to the elder of the tribe, and getting his permission to be there and to be in the land. And in the book, you speak of elders as well in your culture, and you make a reference to say, I don't think of myself as an elder or a future elder, but I'm wondering, what do you think is the future of Native American culture as this generation of elders passes away?
Well, my generation of elders have all gone except for one that I recall. So that's a really sad thing. Mm-hmm. And it does mean something very different for us. And I just read, you know, there's a lot of controversy with Native people around Thanksgiving, right? Mm-hmm. Because it becomes the national day of mourning for some, and others like me, and I've written, you can just put Randy Woodley Thanksgiving and come up with about 5 different articles in different places. I've written that I think it's a time, one of the few times that we have to actually celebrate that there was some camaraderie, at least for a little while. And we don't have enough of those myths. But I just read a young Navajo woman, and she said that she would feed the pilgrims if she had it to do over again, which is a sort of a radical statement with some people who are saying, you know, we hate the pilgrims. Mm-hmm. This is the beginning of our oppression. But she said, because our teachings teach us to love and to feed those who are hungry and to take care of them. And so we have to be able to do that regardless of what the outcome is going to be. And, you know, and I said in a comment, you know, this is the heart of the elders who taught me as well. Those are the most tolerant, loving, wise people that I will probably ever know on earth. Hmm. And most of them are gone now. So, yeah. And now we have, you know, I don't want to be too harsh, but what I would call like neo-traditional people.
Okay.
Who are intolerant. And like, that's probably one of the most characteristic things. And to be intolerant is not the teachings that I received. And to be very tolerant and accepting is a better way for us all to live. So yeah, I think we're in trouble, and we need to continue to listen to the voices of some of those who have gone on, and hopefully some who are still here. So
it seems like there's a fine line between tolerance and openness and acceptance and standing up for what you believe, right? And I'm imagining there's a lot of that tension in Indigenous American culture.
Yeah. You know, we have our things that we have to deal with. It's, and, you know, I think being able to admit when you're wrong is a big thing. It's okay to be wrong. It's just as long as you admit when you're wrong. Mm-hmm. I've had to do that a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, cultivating humility. And it's nice to have people around you who will assist you in cultivating that humility by reminding you that you're just a human being.
Yeah. Yep. Can you think of a parallel in the Christian tradition? Can you think of a parallel to the elders in Native American culture?
So, you know, I've known a lot of great white people who I would say are like elders. Yeah. But we always say they're elders and they're old people. Mm-hmm. And it's not the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I look for that like heart of tolerance and wisdom and love and care and acceptance you know, what, regardless of where it's coming from, I think, you know, you don't have to be Native to have wisdom.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's veer back into the nerddom for a little bit if we can. So you said at one point, I'm going to quote this here, "I call Native American religious reality epistemological orthopraxy."
Yeah, I love it.
"Where truth comes by understanding how others have lived." Now, as a philosopher, when somebody starts talking about truth in that way, I immediately start to wonder what you mean. So if you could dig a little deeper into that for us, that'd be great.
Yeah, well, truth's kind of a slippery thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we come to know what is true? The base, and I really went into this a lot deeper in my book in 2010 called Shalom and the Community of Creation and Indigenous Vision. Hmm. But where we in the West are taught, the educational system in particular, is to pass knowledge, you know, from one person to the other, whereas in the Native way is to pass experience. And so what I know because I've heard it, read it, someone has told me, is not at all knowledge. Not, in fact, knowledge without that experience is pretty, actually is damaging. So it's like, you know, what have I actually done and what have I experienced? And what about the experiences of others, they count, that counts too, right? So we don't have to always learn from our own mistakes. But, and that's the point of a lot of our stories and ceremonies and songs and things like this, is to learn these things, to learn what happens when, you know, you get prideful and coyote comes for you and, you know, and you get lost and all those kinds of things. This is what all these stories are about, is to try and teach us things. But I also can't just say, well, because I know these stories, I have wisdom or I know truth. It's when it's put to the test in life. And so people who live that discover what truth is, and people who don't live it don't have truth.
Mm-hmm. So the ortho part of the orthopraxy is grounded in what? Is it a kind of group flourishing or trial and error?
I'd say the ortho is about common values. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the common values that we all share. Really, we would say common good, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the Western world. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many more things.
I know. I'll ask another question and you can.
Parallels.
Yeah. So kind of related. You speak to harmony being seemingly the goal of Indigenous American theology or spirituality. And I loved what you, you know, the 10 tenets of most Native American religions or spirituality. And when you speak of harmony, it reminds me so much of what Christians would call new creation, or what our Jewish brothers and sisters would call shalom. Can you speak to this idea of harmony being the goal to which this is our work as human beings and as people on the land, and how that might be something that you can see in all cultures, basically?
Yeah. So I came at this knowing that in my own culture and several Native cultures I've been around, we had a sort of a harmony way, right? In Cherokee, we would call it, one of the words for it would be Elohe.
What does that mean?
Elohe, it means harmony. It means peace. It means, you know, everybody's being fed. Nobody's going hungry. It means that nobody's at war. It means the ground's healthy and producing what it's supposed to, and life as it's meant to be lived, right? So, and we all, in my PhD dissertation, I queried 45 different tribes and 12 elders, spiritual leaders, and everybody, every single tribe had a harmony way construct, right? And then I began to realize that because I was going to school with about 60% from people around the world, that also Ikalahan Filipinos had that same harmony way, but they call it something else. And Sami people up in Scandinavia had it, and Zulus have it. They call it Umbutu. And, you know, Maasai have it. And, you know, Maori have it in New Zealand, and Aboriginal people have it. And so it's like, these are the original instructions. These are the original ways to live, the original values. And that's why also you find it in ancient Judaism. You have shalom. So this is a kind of shalom and tikkun together, this justice and peace and all of these things and all the derivatives of that. And I go into that deeply again in this book, Shalom and the Community of Creation, and compare the Native American harmony way to really Walter Brueggemann's construct of shalom. And there's so many similarities in those 10 values that I found, which all have sort of subsidiary values as well, but those would all be consistent with the teachings of Jesus. Jesus came, you know, I think we have the whole understanding of what the purpose of Jesus was and is wrong. He came about restoring this ancient system of shalom and what I call the Shalom Sabbath Jubilee construct. And he makes it abundantly clear in Luke chapter 4. Mm-hmm. And Luke really makes it clear throughout his whole book. But yeah, so there's a lot of similarities. And I think that if we can live that way, that's not only the way that indigenous people have been taught to live, but it's the way that Jesus taught us to live. The Western worldview is what has disrupted that. Mm-hmm. The Western worldview, as it's involved itself with empire, and that includes the church as well, is toxic to the harmony way. It teaches the opposite values. Its teachings are antithetical to the teachings of Jesus. It's about competition, not cooperation. It's about, you know, greed, not about sharing. It's about, you know, individualism, not, you know, corporate thinking. It's, you know, and I go through, actually, I have a number of charts and stuff in that book that compare this. And I know there's more than one Western worldview, and I know there's more than one indigenous worldview, but I'm talking about the general worldview that is ubiquitous throughout our colonial systems of education and economics and, you know, our social systems and, you know, our legal systems, etc. So all of those are built on principles that are against the harmony way, against shalom, against the teachings of Jesus.
I want to talk a little bit about racism, if I can, and kind of bring it down. Apologies. So you talk in the book about, you call it post-colonial stress disorder. Can you describe mm-hmm. what that is?
Yeah. Eduardo Durand has written a book about post-colonial stress syndrome for Native people. He's a psychologist. He's written several books, actually, but on trauma. And basically, we know that our trauma is passed on intergenerationally. And almost all Native people, if not all Native people, suffer from post-colonial stress syndrome. And it's basically having everything taken from you, told that you're no good, and then left you in a bunch of systems that leave you powerless, and to say, now just be like one of us. And that's very traumatic. It's very stressful. And then as a result, it creates a lot of dysfunction. And then we begin to now have people who are victims of post-traumatic stress syndrome because of the individual things that happen as a result of post-colonial stress syndrome. Is that helpful?
Yeah, yeah, very helpful. You also, so I want to talk about systemic injustice, and that was kind of a segue into that. So you have one of the simpler explanations of systemic injustice, and I would class racism in as a type of that, but it's not just racism, that I've encountered, and I love it, and it's very pedagogical, and it involves parents and DNA, and I'm wondering if you could just give us that metaphor.
Yeah, this is one of my sort of things I give to every group of my students. I forgot to say that I'm also a professor at a Portland Seminary. Mm-hmm. So I'm always saying to my classes, you know, it's sort of things work like this, structures work like this. Everybody wants a change, right? But everybody also wants homeostasis. In other words, the things to stay the same. I want change as long as it doesn't affect anything differently.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so people want to keep their salaries. People want to keep their jobs. And when you start changing things, it creates what they think is instability, right? And so they say, okay, well, let's fix the system by doing this, and let's fix this. But it's always the same parents who are fixing the system. So if the system has only two parents, you can only get DNA from those two parents. Mm-hmm. And so the only way to introduce new DNA is to invite another parent in. In other words, someone with power, someone with authority to be able to change things. And so this is how things begin to move and change. It's different than tokenism. It's mm-hmm. actually giving people who, like, if we're talking about racism, for example, and I always say, don't hire one person of color, hire several. And when we all sit down and create something together, we have a different outcome. Otherwise, it ends up just history repeats itself. And in a way, an easy structure to look at this in is the church. So how many generations have they been sitting around dying going, how do we get young people in the church? Mm-hmm. Well, you put a bunch of young people in charge of deciding how you get young people in the church, right?
Yeah.
But so otherwise you just keep try this and that and everything else, or how do you draw people to church, you know, the church buildings. And so, you know, we had all these different movements, and the megachurch movement and the Hillsong movement and the, you know, all the different things that try to appeal to people. But did you ever think about, like, asking the non-church people why they would even want to come to church? Mm-hmm. I mean, so you have to begin to think outside the box. One of the problems is that we build structures in the West, like I said, toward homeostasis. We don't build the way that God builds. God builds in open systems, like fractals, right? God builds in systems that adapt. Nature's number one rule is adaptation. It's like nature's going to survive because it knows how to adapt, but people don't. And so when we think of everything is in chaos, like right now, climate change, for example, we think that's chaos, but that's actually nature doing what nature does. It's adapting. It's like, okay, if people are going to be the number one consumers of energy and they're supposed to only be tertiary consumers, then I'm going to adapt by getting rid of people, right? and so what we think is chaos is actually order. And what we call order, which is fighting against entropy, fighting against adaptation, fighting against change, that's what's chaos. That's what's chaotic.
As we think about repair and healing that needs to be done and reparations that need to happen between white Americans and Native Americans, you say in the book at one point that Europeans always ask, what can we do? And we want a quick fix. And this doesn't seem to be something you think is helpful. What are better questions we can ask? What is a better journey towards healing and harmony and reparations, Randy?
Well, I think listening's really good, you know,
for a long time. Yep.
And then maybe a better question than, because there's a lot of presumptions with the, you know, how can we fix this? It's like the presumption, especially from white folks who have been taught, and part of this is the fault of the land itself. The land itself is so open and so non-limiting that it created a culture that is very open and thinking that it could basically solve any problem, right? And so so part of that is actually just being an American. But the assumption also is like, because the relationship between white folks and non-white folks, particularly if we think about Native Americans, has been very much the subject to the object, right? Hmm. Whether it's mission or anything else, it's like, we are the subject and you are the object. Mm-hmm. And so we're objectified, right? Yeah. So if you're going to begin to ask those questions, then you have to think differently. And you have to say, all right, I'm here. Or even like, just show up and be on the outside. And then when someone says, why are you here? Then you get the chance to talk. Like I tell people all the time, they're like, well, how do we get to know the natives in our area? I'm like, well, they have powwows and they have public events all the time. Ask if you can be on the cleanup crew. And maybe after three or four times, there's somebody's going to say, hey, why don't you guys come out here anyway, you know? And then maybe you'll make a friend, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's sort of the presumption of saying, how do we fix this? Means that, like, one, we're white, we're American. Of course we can fix this. Mm-hmm. And that also means that, of course, you're not white. And you can't fix this. In other words, you're helpless. You're the object. And so, and then the assumption also is like that it can be fixed. Mm. So if it could be fixed so easily, you know, it would have been fixed a long time ago. But there is a place in the power dynamic where the people in power have to actually say, yes, there is a part that we have to play in fixing this. But it should be basically as junior partners, not large and in charge, which is the American way, but saying to the people who have been oppressed or objectified, or whether it's women or whoever it is, you know, you guys are in charge, kind of tell us what to do, mm-hmm. you know.
Do you have any real hope that that will occur in the United States?
Of course. I've seen it. I mean, it's... if I didn't have hope, I wouldn't be doing this, because it's cost too much. It's cost me too much. Mm-hmm. So I have hopes that even if I don't see a lot of things happen in my lifetime, that eventually my children or grandchildren will. So, and that's what I'm working towards.
You say that you've been running a sweatshop for a sweatshop.
Hold on.
Hold on.
Just to clarify, I do not run a sweatshop.
Good. All right. Let's start that over. You say you've run a sweatshop.
Jesus, right? God almighty. Now it's in your hand.
Yep.
Yeah, that's why I get my clothes so cheap. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Take three.
Yep. You say you've been running a sweat lodge for about 30 years and you've seen remarkable things. One of the things you say in the book is that you've seen like the whitest of white people spend a night in the sweat lodge and be completely transformed because of that one night. I want to know what happens in a sweat lodge and what's so transformative, and can I come and spend a night in your sweat lodge?
That's what he really wants to know. Can I do that?
Oh, it's a great mystery. No, I'm just teasing. So a sweat lodge is it's sort of like a sauna, right? You've mm-hmm. been to a sauna. Mm-hmm. So it's like a Swedish sauna, but and think of a Native American sauna that's made of earth and rocks on a and it marries a Wednesday night prayer meeting. And that's what a sweat is. So you're inside, rocks are brought in that are hot, you pour water on them, people are in this circle under this, you know, tent like thing, this half round canvas thing, and you pray and you share songs and you share what's on your heart, and you know, that's what takes place. And it happens in a complete dark with sweat pouring out of your body, mm-hmm. and prayers come in songs, and it's sharing from your heart out of your, you know, the depth of you. And it's just a very holistic, complete embodiment experience that I think a lot of white people have never had. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes it just clicks and they're changed. Yeah. But I mean, it happens for a lot of people, not just white people, but I've seen some pretty, what somebody might say, double white people, all of a sudden realize that there's so much more to life than sort of this lot they've been given by attending church and sitting and watching the back of somebody's head and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a death of spirituality, if you will. Yeah.
And is it the sensory experience and the darkness and the extreme?
Yeah. I think it's all that, you know, it's all that.
Yeah. Sounds fascinating.
And yes. Once we get our sweat, we haven't been running sweat for 2 years because of COVID.
Okay.
So it's basically like a Petri dish, right?
Yeah.
So as soon as COVID says goodbye, we put the sweat back up.
Brilliant. Do you have anything else, Kyle?
You didn't answer if Randy could come.
Oh, yeah.
That was the ulterior motive.
You may.
All right.
We're not in there all night, just so you know. I mean, they only last usually a couple hours, 2-3 hours.
I mean, I'm sure that's an intensely long time in the pitch black and in an environment like that.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Awesome. Well, Randy Woodley, it's been really awesome talking to you. It could easily have gone a couple more hours. Maybe we can do it again. I've got bunch of more books of yours I want to read now. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. That really was a lot of fun. And we would definitely come knocking on your publisher's door again. We'd love to crack open another book and have another conversation.
Well, yeah, the last one I published is called Mission and the Cultural Other.
We didn't even talk about missions, which is kind of one of your main things, right?
So if you want to talk about that sometime, that would be good, because it's a whole different approach. And basically what I say is that Western missions is the foundation of Western missions is white supremacy.
So. Yeah, man. Yeah, we could dig
Let's
into
do
that
it. For yeah, sure. We must. Yes, yep, absolutely. Awesome.
You guys know that we have a podcast too, right?
Do you
know that?
No. Why don't you go ahead and give a blurb for it and we'll include it in the episode.
Okay, yeah. So it's Bo Sanders and myself. He used to be with Trip Fuller and Theology Nerd Throwdown and Homebrewed Christianity.
Yep.
But anyway, he and I do one called Piecing It All Together, PEACING.
Nice.
Yeah, we've done close to 100 episodes now, I think.
What do you guys talk about?
Everything.
They piece it together, Randy, obviously.
All right, guys. Good to meet you, and I hope to see you down the road here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Take care, Randy. All right.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for this episode of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you're enjoying the show as much as we are. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher, where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and Spotify. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode, if it's good enough.
If anything we said really pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, or if you'd just like to send us booze, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Catch all of our hot takes on Twitter at @PPWBpodcast, @RandyNye, and @RobertKWhitaker, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com. See you next time.
Cheers.